Understanding Harry Potter by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. A look at the Harry Potter series in an attempt to understand and respond to the controversy over whether it's Christian and should be read by Christian children. What's the buzz? This adventure series for kids and for grown-ups has sold many millions of copies in many languages. The 7-volume book series is now complete as of 2007. 5 films have been made to date, with 2 more still to come. The series has become controversial in Christian circles. What's the controversy about? Well, the series is about an orphan, Harry Potter, who learns on his 11th birthday that he is really a wizard. He discovered that his parents were killed by the wicked wizard Lord Voldemort when Harry was only about 1 year old. The series then follows his years of study at Hogwarts, a school for training witches and wizards, his further adventures, and his encounters with Lord Voldemort. Many Christian parents are concerned that the stories may influence their children to get involved in witchcraft. Others feel this is just part of the fantasy world, like those of C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien, that helps to make the stories exciting, and that the adventures themselves can help kids experience the real-world struggle between good and evil on a level that will prepare them for adult life. What can we say about this? Well, parents obviously have an awesome responsibility raising their kids. If you feel there's significant danger that your child might get involved in witchcraft as a result of this series, naturally you would not want to let them read the books or watch the films. However, I do think you should view the rest of this talk before making your final decision. Let me tell you about my experience. I'm not a parent. I do have 11 nieces and nephews, plus 14 great-nieces and nephews. But the difference between a parent and being an uncle is that you can, in some sense, walk away from things. You're only doing part-time contact and that sort of thing. I am a lifelong bachelor, a retired seminary professor, and a great fan of the writings of C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. When I first heard of the Harry Potter stories, about the time the second or third book came out, the news and reviews about it did not sound very attractive to me. One of my nephews, however, had read the books, and he said they were quite good and I should try them. I did. They were good. The first thing I noticed, having taught apologetics for many years, is that the books were surely not written by an occultist. For instance, the author passed up numerous opportunities to dump on Christianity, for example, by making the Dursleys out to be fundamentalists or Catholics or Anglicans, which the author does not do. I begin to suspect, as I read the books, that the author's agenda might be something like that of Lewis or Tolkien, particularly when I heard that J.K. Rowling was a professing Christian. Lewis, in an essay entitled Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best What's to Be Said, remarks, "Why did one as a child find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings, and reverence itself did harm. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could." This comes from the essay we mentioned, published in a collection of Lewis's essays of Other Worlds, page 37. Let's talk about the Harry Potter series. Like Lewis's Narnia Chronicles and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Rowling's Harry Potter series has magic, wizards, and strange creatures. Unlike the Narnia books, the Christianity in Harry Potter is not explicit. But I would suggest that Christianity is more obvious in Potter than it is in Tolkien. Let's do a quick tour of the Potter books. Very quick, you'll see here. Book 1, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Harry learns that he's a wizard. He begins school at Hogwarts. He makes friends with Hermione and Ron, and we learn a lot about the magical world. Harry becomes a Quidditch star. As you can see him here on the cover of the hardback American edition of the hardback after the snitch on his broomstick. At the end, Harry meets and defeats Lord Voldemort. Book 2, Chamber of Secrets, covers the second year at Hogwarts. Now Ron's little sister, Ginny Weasley, begins school. As the school year goes on, it appears that some kind of unseen monster begins turning people into stone, and that this monster is somehow connected with the Chamber of Secrets being opened, which no one knows where it is, in the school. Finally, Harry rescues Ginny from the chamber, kills the monster, and destroys what has been the trouble all this year, Voldemort's diary, in which he has implanted a memory of himself. Book 3, The Prisoner of Azkaban. We now have year 3 of Hogwarts, and we learn early on that an escaped murderer, Sirius Black, is apparently after Harry. Harry arrives at Hogwarts, rides a hippogriff, continues his career as a Quidditch star, meets Remus Lupin, one of his teachers, Defense Against Dark Arts teacher, and at the end of the book, Harry and Hermione save the hippogriff, and Sirius, who turns out to be really innocent after all. Book 4, The Goblet of Fire, and Harry's fourth year. In this year, there's going to be a Tri-Wizard tournament held at Hogwarts for the first time in over a century. Three people to be entered in it that are entered by drawing their names out of the Goblet of Fire. And Harry is secretly entered into the dangerous Tri-Wizard tournament by someone slipping his name into the Goblet of Fire. Over the course of the year, he faces rejection, ridicule, and danger as he competes in the three tests. Finally, at the end of the year, he's kidnapped and nearly killed by Voldemort, escaping with the help from the phantoms of his parents. Book 5, The Order of the Phoenix. We now reach Harry's fifth year at Hogwarts, and Voldemort, at the end of the last book, had now returned to his own body and has begun to build up his own sinister organization, including his main henchmen, the Death Eaters. But the Minister of Magic won't admit this, so Dumbledore formed the Order of the Phoenix to oppose Voldemort. Well, by the time we reach the end of the year, this book, Harry and his friends, seeking to rescue Sirius, face Voldemort's Death Eaters. They escape, but Sirius is killed. Book 6, The Half-Blood Prince. Harry is instructed by Dumbledore on the mysterious history of Voldemort. They learn that Voldemort has divided his soul and put the pieces in various objects to become immortal. These objects could be ordinary objects of one sort or another, although Voldemort seems to have picked ones that are particularly associated with his own history and the history of Hogwarts. But when the pieces of soul have been put in an object, that object is called a Horcrux. At the end of the book, Dumbledore is killed by Snape in an attack on Hogwarts by the Death Eaters. Harry must now seek and destroy these Horcruxes. Book 7, Deathly Hallows. At the beginning of this book, Voldemort manages to take control of the Ministry of Magic. Harry, Ron, and Hermione have to flee and working undercover, seeking the Horcruxes in which Voldemort has hidden his soul. Finally, Harry and Voldemort meet in a thrilling climax. Well, that's a quick sketch. There's lots and lots of detail in those stories. They're very well done. But one might well ask, where's God in all of this? Admittedly, there is no mention of God in Harry Potter. There are a few mention of churches. A minister shows up twice, I believe, once in the funeral for Voldemort, he's not called a minister, and once in the marriage that takes place at the beginning of the last book. But really, there is no mention of God in Harry Potter. As Lev Grossman says in a Time article dated July 12, 2007, entitled, Who Dies in Harry Potter? God. Grossman says, Harry Potter lives in a world free of any religion or spirituality of any kind. He lives surrounded by ghosts, but has no one to pray to, even if he were so inclined, which he isn't. Rowling has more in common with celebrity atheists like Christopher Hitchens than she does with Tolkien and Lewis. Even after reading the last book of the series, Grossman says, her insistence, Rowling's insistence, on this point is a reflection of the cosmology of the Potterverse, that is, the Potter universe. There are no higher powers in residence there. The attic and the basement are empty. There may be an afterlife and ghosts, but there is certainly no God and no devil. That's the July 21, 2007 issue of Time. Is Grossman right? Well, yes and no. There is no explicit mention of God in Harry Potter, but neither is there in Lord of the Rings. Nor, we should note, in the Old Testament book of Esther. The non-mention of God in a book does not necessarily mean the author does not believe in God. What are we to make of this? Let's look first of all at what Harry Potter does say. What does Harry Potter teach? Talking about the series, not about the main character. It teaches that there's an objective difference between right and wrong, a concept that gets very little play in our secular society, pretty well ignored in our education and such. It teaches that there's some sort of afterlife without giving us a clear picture of just what this is like. It teaches that love is real and all-important, which is a central feature of Christianity. Remember Jesus' two greatest commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And remember Paul's exposition on love in 1 Corinthians 13. The series teaches that there's a difference between good and bad people, but that even good people have plenty of badness. It teaches that bad things often happen to good people, but that this is no reason for despair. It teaches us that we are not in control of our own destiny without giving us a clear picture of whether someone beyond is or is not in control. I think perhaps it hints that something beyond is, but the hints are not so explicit even as in Lord of the Rings, where at one point Gandalf says to Frodo Bilbo's finding the ring indicated a purpose. There's nothing explicit statement like that. It teaches us that making immortality our goal can lead to disastrous evil, while being willing to give up our lives can be the greatest form of love. The series teaches that our choices show and determine who we really are, not our abilities, not our background, not our circumstances. Well, with all these good teachings that are certainly consistent with Christianity, why is there no reference to God? Well, the author doesn't explicitly tell us, but she gives about hints about God, which we shall see in a bit, which certainly rule out the idea that she did not believe in God. Perhaps the author wants us to think through certain moral questions, even experience where they will lead, without being put off by the feeling that there's something religious and that we're being preached to. You know, Jesus does something like this in several of his parables. Think of the one of the two debtors, where his host at this dinner has decided that because Jesus let this immoral woman pour perfume on him and such, that Jesus can't really be a prophet. And Jesus responds by giving him a parable of the two debtors and then asking him things. And essentially, Jesus is sneaking up on the host, getting him to make a moral judgment before he realizes that that judgment is about himself. So does the prophet Nathan in the Old Testament when he seeks to confront David with his sin concerning Uriah and Bathsheba. Wants them to think through a moral question without Uriah realizing it applies to him. Well, what are these hints? Rowling gives a number of hints. We're going to sketch some of them. I'll give you a reference at the end of the PowerPoint talk here sketches quite a few of them. These hints show up, first of all, in Rowling's choices of the names of bad characters. Voldemort, will to death. Malfoy, bad faith. Draco, dragon, biblical picture for Satan. Slytherin, the name of the house in Hogwarts school that that are the bad guys, if you like. Obviously a play on a slithering snake, and so likewise a biblical picture for Satan. Whinging, the town that the Dursleys live in, where Harry grows up, being mistreated by them, but being hosted by them, is British for whining or complaining, which is an excellent fit to the Dursley family activity, particularly the father's. Well, those are some lists of rolling, a short list of rolling choices of bad names. There's a huge list of name meanings at this website, MuggleNet.com, that I give you here at the bottom of this page. These hints also show up in Rowling's choices of good names. Lovegood for Luna and her father's Anopheles. Potter for Harry. Common English name, huh? But one of the biblical pictures of God is the potter and we're the clay. Granger, Hermione's family name. Well, what's a granger? A granger's a farmer. And a biblical picture of God is the farmer and we're the plants. Gryffindor. What's that? Well, Gryffindor, gold griffin. See our discussion of symbolism later. These hints show up in a couple of Bible quotations that appear in the last book of the series, The Deathly Hallows. On the Dumbledore family tombstone, when Harry and Hermione finally reach Godric's Hollow, there's an inscription at the bottom, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." No hint is given where this comes from, but anyone who knows the Bible will realize that that is a Bible verse, and if you scout around, it's in Matthew chapter 6, verse 21. That's found on page 325 of the hardback edition of the Deathly Hallows. On the Potter family tombstone, the inscription, "The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." And again, no hint where that comes from or that that even comes from the Bible. And Harry explicitly doesn't know anything about what it means, and Hermione doesn't seem to know where it comes from, but she does put a little more positive spin on what the epitaph means. Well, that comes from Paul's chapter about resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15. This comes in verse 26, and that whole section of the narrative can be found on page 328 of the hardback Deathly Hallows. These hints also show up in the author's symbolism. Take, for instance, some animals that are mentioned. The phoenix. Fox the phoenix is Dumbledore's pet bird, and the one who comes to Harry's aid in the Chamber of Secrets because Harry is loyal to Dumbledore. A stag. The stag is the form which Harry's and his father's Patronus takes. The unicorn. The unicorn is an animal which is studied at Hogwarts, being a magical animal. It's killed by Voldemort because its blood gives some sort of a limited cursed life. Harry's Patronus is said to look something like a unicorn in Prisoner of Azkaban, hardback, page 385. What do we know about the phoenix? The phoenix is a mythological bird that dies in the flames and comes back to life from the ashes, mentioned already in the classical authors of Greece and Rome. In medieval bestiaries, the phoenix is an allegory of the death and resurrection of Christ. We can also picture the resurrection of the righteous. The stag, of course, is a real animal, a male deer. According to medieval bestiaries, it's a symbol for Christ who tramples and destroys the devil. The stag is viewed as trampling and then eating snakes, and in this picture at the right from a medieval manuscript, we see the stag eating a snake. Unicorn. Unicorn is a mythological beast that looks like a horse but has a single horn. It may be tamed by a virgin, as we see in this picture again from a bestiary. In the bestiaries, it symbolizes Christ. So there's three symbolic animals, and they all have Christian symbolism in the medieval bestiaries, which Joanne Rowling, with her particular education she'd had, would probably have known something about. further on in the author symbolism, we have the lion, the symbol of Gryffindor House at Hogwarts. The griffin, Godric Gryffindor's name comes from Golden Griffin. The snake, the symbol for Slytherin House at Hogwarts. And the basilisk, the monster in the Chamber of Secrets. Look at these four beasts. The lion, of course, already in the Bible, is applied to the tribe of Judah in Genesis 49 and to Jesus in Revelation chapter 5. In the bestiaries, the lion is regularly seen as Christ. The griffin. Griffin is a mythological animal with a combination of lion and eagle. Both the lion and the eagle have been seen as symbols of Christ. The snake. The snake is an animal that has already been seen as symbolic of Satan in Bible times. Again, see Genesis 3 and Revelation 12. The basilisk is a mythological beast that is pictured as a crested snake, or here, as a cock with a snake's tail. The name in Greek and Latin means king, with the idea of being king of the serpents. So it, too, is connected with Satan. So the two bad animals, if you like, two of the bad animals that show up in the Harry Potter series are connected with Satan, and several of the good animals are explicitly connected with Christ. Explicitly meaning not explicitly in the series, but explicitly in Christian symbolism. The Deathly Hallows. This is the topic that first shows up explicitly in the last book of the series. The Deathly Hallows are three items that together are alleged to make their possessor invulnerable. The Elder Wand, more powerful than any of the other magic wands. The Resurrection Stone, which will recall others from death. And the Cloak of Invisibility, which will not wear out or be overcome by spells. It turns out, as the story develops, that Harry has had this particular cloak of invisibility, ever since his first year, when it was given back to him by Albus Dumbledore. It had belonged to Harry's father. The Elder Wand, it turns out, and we only learn this in last book, is the wand which Dumbledore has had for some time. And the Resurrection Stone turns out to be one of the Horcruxes, but Voldemort, when he made it a Horcrux, did not realize what it was. It had belonged to the family. He was the last descendant of Salazar Slytherin. At the beginning of chapter 21, we're given a diagram that symbolizes the threefold Deathly Hallows. And you see it there, a triangle with a circle inscribed inside it, and then a straight line down the middle of the triangle, vertically. We're told in the story that the triangle represents the cloak, the circle represents the stone, and the line represents the wand. Well, it's interesting to think about the symbolism of this thing. Except for the vertical line, this is a standard symbol for the Trinity. We're told in one book on symbolism, a circle is an endless line having no beginning and end, which symbolizes eternity or God. An equilateral triangle having all sides of equal length and each angle equal represents one God in three persons. This is probably one of the earliest symbolic representations of the Trinity. On the website Mike's Wanderings, not sure how it's pronounced, at freewebs.com and the rest of that long address, the author explains the symbolism of straight lines. The line is a symbol of boundary and division. A straight line represents infinity because it can continue in either direction indefinitely. A vertical line represents the spiritual world, and a horizontal line the temporal world. The horizontal line represents a path of birth to death, beginning to end, and the dual nature of man, left and right, good and evil, male and female. The horizontal line also represents the feminine principle. A vertical line symbolizes man, the body, the spine, the tree of life, and the path from earth to heaven. the realm of the spirit, masculine principle. Using these ideas, we could say that the vertical line represents Jesus, the man, the perfect man, the one who came down from heaven, but who is also part of the Trinity. And then we get this symbol, which is in fact the very symbol which Rowling uses for the Deathly Hallows. Let's look at one last item in the Harry Potter series, the London Railway Station, from which Harry, Ron, and Hermione travel each year to Hogwarts. This is the King's Cross Station, one of several railway stations in the north part of London, and a natural place of departure for points north. This is also the place that Rowling chooses for Harry to wake up in when he has just been zapped by Voldemort with the Avada Kedavra curse and is presumed dead. And it's not the regular King's Cross Station with all the crowd going around. It's an empty, rather ethereal place in which there's only Harry and some little thing flopping around, which, although never identified, is presumably the part of Voldemort that has just been killed in the curse when Voldemort, killing Harry, inadvertently then kills the part of his own soul that he had put in Harry accidentally. Well, it turns out that Harry is not dead, or at least that he can choose to go back, which he does. This celestial version of the King's Cross Station is thus some sort of way station between life and death, and it is to this place that Dumbledore comes in order to meet with Harry. The King's Cross. Do you get it? The name of this way station between this life and the life beyond is the King's Cross. And certainly Jesus, pictured as King of Kings, Lord of Lords, the King's Cross is certainly a very appropriate name from a Christian perspective. Are we to believe that J.K. Rowling used this name merely by accident? I think, instead, that she is telling us something. Some conclusions. Is the Harry Potter series a Christian work? Well, that depends on what you mean by Christian. I think it was clearly written by a professing Christian and is filled with Christian symbolism. None of it, the writer, were telling you that this is Christian symbolism. I do not think it was written primarily for Christians. I think it was written for secular readers to get them thinking about ultimate questions. I think some of these ultimate questions are, what is life all about? Is there anything beyond this life? Isn't there really a powerful difference between love and hate, between sacrifice and selfishness? Is there perhaps an invisible world all around us? We could perhaps spend more time in thinking about this. In some sense, I think Rowling has substituted the world of magic, which is slightly back in vogue now, to attract readers, but get them to think about, is there more to this world that we actually live in than just this natural law and this closed universe that the secularist would like us to think there is? In some sense, then, she uses this magical world as a substitute for the supernatural, for the miraculous. Well, for further study, particularly for more on symbolism in the Harry Potter series, I recommend to you John Granger, Looking for God in Harry Potter, published by Salt River, an imprint of Tyndale House, in 2004. Well, that's the end of our talk. My suggestion, having thought through some of these things, why don't you give Harry Potter another read?